Hey everybody, this is Dave Menichetti from Y&T, and you're listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast. Turn it up!
We're really getting the hang of this now, aren't we? There's more chat, tunes and news this month, including a unique and frank conversation with Black Sabbath drummer Bill Ward about 40 years of Paranoid, what Sabbath might be doing next, and other less savoury topics.
They've travelled some dark roads, and I don't regret them, because I probably wouldn't be able to be sitting here comfortably with you right now, Oliver, and saying the things that I'm saying had I not travelled some of those dark roads.
San Francisco stalwarts Y&T have been round the track several times and thankfully are still going round it, now with a shiny new album to make it more fun. While talking about that and other things, head honcho Dave Menichetti provides more proof that everyone has a good Aussie story.
And here's Ozzy and Sharon back there waiting for us in our dressing room. And it was a big room, and the guys walked about 20, 30 feet away from me. And Ozzy gets down on his knees and says, "Dave, will you please join my band?" And, you know, all of a sudden Ozzy's at my feet asking me to join his band, and I was like, what the hell's going on? This is weird.
And the multi-talented Robin George talks about what he's been up to for the last 25 years, including his nearly gig with Thin Lizzy.
There was Brian Downey, the drummer, me and Phil on the plane, and Phil said, "I want to reform Thin Lizzy, are you in?" And we both went, "Yeah, of course, yeah, we'd love to." Next thing I knew, a radio station called up and said, "Can you comment on Phil's demise?" You know, and that was the first I knew about it. I knew he wasn't very well, but I didn't have any idea that he was in such a terrible state that he was, bless him.
And talking of Robin George, from his first album, Dangerous Music, in 1985. Recently re-released through the excellent Angel Air label with bonus tracks, it's a classic album and contains his biggest hit, Heartline.
Your crazy attitude is spoiling everyone's fun. All you wanna do is take the money and run. All I ever get from you is days without sun. It's much too late to change your mind, the damage is done. I've tried to see your point of view, but baby, come on. The situation's vacant now, the season has gone. All I wanna know is why it took me so long. It's much too late to change your tune, I don't like this song.
Hard time.
Your mind is always engaged.
Hard time.
Here's the news this month. Gene Simmons incurred the wrath of the online community last month when he suggested that everyone who's ever shared music be sued by the industry. He said, make sure there are no incursions, sue everybody, be litigious, take their homes, their cars, don't let anybody cross that line. He soon learned the error of his ways, though, after his websites genesimmons.com and simmonsrecords.com were the victims of denial of service assaults by disgruntled geeks, rendering them inoperable for hours. Two members of the Guns N' Roses touring lineup, Ron Bumblefoot Thal and Frank Ferrer, don't worry if you haven't heard of them, visited a music school in Whitney, Oxfordshire to offer advice and jam with pupils. Ferrer joked he was more nervous talking to the children than playing for thousands of fans in London, presumably because he had to be on time as opposed to several hours late. Now on to real Guns N' Roses members, and the shock news this month was that Duff McKagan joined the band for four songs at the O2 Arena show in London. Apparently he happened to be staying at the same hotel as Axl, and before you knew it, hatchets were buried and he was being handed a bass while watching from the side of the stage. Well, two fists is better than nothing, I suppose. Talking of reunions or potential reunions, John Lord reckons that Richie Blackmore might be up for a Deep Purple Mark III reunion, but he's not so sure about Ian Paice, who's still a part of the current lineup, and he's not too sure about David Coverdale's voice either. Housewives favourites Bon Jovi to receive a Global Icon Award at the MTV Awards this month. Bruce Gilmer of MTV Network said they were one of the most beloved and influential rock bands of all time. Ozzy's been handing out health advice in his Ask Dr. Ozzy column in Rolling Stone magazine. He's been offering advice to a Hawaiian desperate to give up beer and lose weight, and a Los Angeles fan who's just found out her son is surfing for porn online. He was talking to a Turkish fan about his vertigo issues, suggesting that he go to bed, drink only water, then get up and walk around in circles for a bit, and if you're still dizzy, let me know. He said, I thought I had vertigo. I went to the doctor and he said, Mr. Osborne, the problem as far as I can tell is simply that you're very, very drunk. Bill Ward was, of course, the original drummer with Black Sabbath from their roots in Aston, Birmingham in 1968, up until his departure shortly after Ozzy Osbourne's exit in 1979. He's had well-documented drink and drugs problems in the past, but for many years now has maintained a strict fitness regime and a vegan diet. He's been working on various solo projects, and on the 40th anniversary of Sabbath's legendary Paranoid album, I was lucky enough to talk to him about all the above, starting with his recollections of that album's release and the band's subsequent launch to being a worldwide household name.
It feels wonderful to know that, you know, we were able to play some music and that it was able to come out and have as much longevity as it has. And also, what's also been following is it's been very complimentary towards the band by journalists and musicians alike, and also, of course, by the fans, you know, and it's helped spawn a few generations now of Sabbath fans, you know. So, I guess it's been very, very positive for everybody, you know. I still cast my mind back to, you know, with the song War Pigs. My head goes to all the veterans that came home in the early 70s coming back from Vietnam. And I can still see them and I can still hear them at the front of the stage. And when we play War Pigs, they just went crazy. You know, some of them didn't have any limbs anymore, so whatever they could put up in the air and shake, they did, you know. So it's quite a quite a absorbing scene to look at that, and that would be the memory. And it's still with me today, you know. Obviously, it's 10 o'clock in the morning and I'm already talking about it, so...
Beyond Aston is an album you've been working on for quite a while, I think. You've been moving stuff backwards and forwards and in and out, and new tracks and old stuff. Is it going to come out? Are we actually going to hear some of it soon?
I've kept about six of the original songs, and then I've put in some fairly newer songs of the last 5 years or so. But Beyond Aston is still being worked on. I actually have an album which we are finishing, and I've been finishing now for the last 2 or 3 months. As he always says, have you finished that fucking album yet? No, he says, you're making a CD, it must be fucking 10 inches wide by now. So I do have my peers pushing me along somewhat, but he loves doing that with me. So we have the first album that will be coming out is an album called Accountable Beasts, 9-song album, and so that'll be coming out really, really soon. I think it'll be a nice album. The next thing we do is we turn around and we go back in the studio and complete Beyond Aston, because all of Beyond Aston is ready to be mixed.
Early on, you were influenced by a lot of the great jazz drummers, Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, but I've heard you say that you're still learning from some of those guys.
Yes, very much so. I'm always learning from the guys in the past. Like if Buddy might play something and I'll go, oh, I hadn't heard that before. I mean, there's always stuff to learn from the greats of the past, but there's so much more to learn from the men that are, and the women that are playing now, you know. One of my favourite influences right now, Gene Hoglan, who plays with Fear Factory.
Right.
And he played with Strapping Young Lad. Now, Gene's got a beautiful technique with his bass drums. You know, he does some pretty good things with his hands as well. So, yeah, so I receive a tremendous amount of input coming to me from other guys. You know, I like what I'm hearing, especially in bass and drums of today.
Mm.
I love the high energy. It reminds me of our band, you know, and it reminds me of our band when we were young. We had such high energy, and the only focus that we had was to play on the stage. It was just like, the stage and the show was so important to us. And when we went on stage, we exploded. And Sabbath was like when we were 22, 23, 24, 25-year-old men. We exploded on that stage. So I'm reminded, you know, with some of the newer bands, their energy levels and their passion, it just reminds me so much of how we Sabbath was in its early years.
Yeah, but they could learn a lesson or two, because you guys were doing two shows a day at one stage, weren't you?
Yes, at one point we were. That took its toll quite quickly, Oliver. That was in the initial days, weeks, and months that followed Paranoid. And that was it's hard going out and giving 100% and then resting and then going out and giving that other 100% that you're supposed to have. So that was very, very hard. It was hard on me as a drummer, because I didn't feel right if I didn't come off completely exhausted. I mean, I didn't feel like I played a gig unless I come off, you know, like I'd been having sex for the last 6 hours or something, you know, or whatever. I'm sorry.
Now, I hope you don't mind talking about this, but I had heard that with all the years of drink and drugs, that you'd actually forgotten a lot of the stuff that you'd learned early on, because when you're drinking, you're not learning properly, and then when you sobered up, the stuff that you'd learned, you hadn't really remembered. Is that right?
It's been a rough journey in that sense. That's a remarkable question as well, I think. I'm glad I'm going to have an opportunity to answer you. Yes, especially when I turned into a daily drinker and a daily user, I could function, but my learning capacity took a little bit of a dive. So when I actually was able to stop drinking and stop using dope, I was quite foggy for a while. And I really did have to relearn most of the things that I've forgotten. I'm still trying to relearn shuffles. There's things that I have to keep going back to that I learned as a kid, especially all my blues stuff and some of the jazz stuff that I learned. I have to keep going there from the original place and then gradually building myself up again. But I did. I've certainly forgotten a lot. And I do, and I become quite frustrated as well. You know, I look back and I go, oh, man, I just can't remember this, and I don't know how I put it together either, you know, so.
I think everyone will appreciate you being so honest about it, and you've obviously travelled some pretty dark roads to get to where you are, but I've often heard you say that you don't have any regrets about any of it.
No, everything that I went through was, I guess, was meant to be, you know, and, you know, I'm sorry that I, you know, well, I'm more sorry, I've tried to make good, you know, where I feel like I've been at fault with other people, where I may have hurt them, you know. So that I'm not comfortable with at all. I try my very best to amend things like that, you know. But yeah, I've traveled some dark roads, and I don't regret them, because I probably wouldn't be able to be sitting here comfortably with you right now, Oliver, and saying the things that I'm saying had I not traveled some of those dark roads. And in that sense, I don't regret them. It's like I'm glad I went through them, because it makes me realize how precious life is and how wonderful life is now, you know. And for the fans, for everybody, first of all, I want to say thank you to everybody who have been absolutely beautiful in my life, but in your lives please be good to yourself, take care of yourself. For those of you who are in despair with alcohol or narcotics, just know that there's a solution. For those of you who are raising the kids now and bringing up the kids, I encourage you to be patient. You know, that's what we have to do in our house. We have to be patient with the kids, you know, because they're learning. It's a whole new world for them. It's a whole new world for me as well. So somewhere in the middle, we have to meet with our children. So, and I can't say enough about continuing to rock. Allow yourselves to listen to what you want. You're not getting old. Nobody's getting old. We can all still have a good time. I'm 62 and I'm having a pretty good time. So I hope that you will have happiness and joy and strength to love in your lives. And I certainly love all of you. And that's what I have to say.
As you can probably tell from that, Bill Ward is a truly remarkable person. I was inspired and elated. It was a very emotional interview. He was very frank and open and honest, and I really thanked him for that. It was amazing to find someone who's been through all of that in his life and has come to terms with everything and is using it to move forward and better himself as a musician and as a person. I found was incredible. There's a lot more of that interview that we're going to make available this month as part of the premium edition of the show at classicrockpodcast.com, and I would highly recommend it. In 2002, fearing retaliation for the September the 11th attacks, Bill Ward wrote a song about the unimaginable happening and sent copies to friends, family and musicians, as well as establishments for humanitarian causes, peace support groups and individuals, and finally governmental heads of state of countries across the world. This is Straws.
I'm sorry to wake you from your sleep now, baby. Open up your eyes. Go downstairs, find some shelter, get some help, and stay alive. How am I supposed to save you in this chaos? Clinging, please don't die. Where are the defenses we were promised? Oh, I hope that they've arrived. Oh,
Y&T have had their ups and downs since their first album in 1974, hitting their peak in the mid-80s but suffering the same fate as many rock bands in the 90s. Touring again in recent years, they released a very welcome new record this year on the Frontiers label to great acclaim across the board, but after the summer festival schedule they were hit with the devastating news that bassist Phil Kennamore had cancer. They decided to temporarily replace Phil for their upcoming headline tour of the UK, and for reasons you'll hear, it was my personal pleasure to interview lead guitarist and vocalist Dave Menichetti, firstly catching up on the most important topic, news of Phil's progress.
He's been going through hell, quite frankly. You know, he's in the middle of his chemotherapy treatments right now, but, you know, the guy's a real strong guy. He's a fighter. He really does have a good attitude about this, as well as you could have. And if anybody could lick this thing, or certainly, you know, do better than what people expect, he would be the guy to do that.
This is quite a historic moment for me because 28 years ago, 3rd of October 1982, Y&T was the very first band I ever saw live. And you won't remember it as well as I do.
But well, that would have been probably with AC/DC, right?
It was Manchester, right. Apollo.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I was 13. I guess it was Open Fire, first song on. And,
right.
So it's all your fault, really. It was, yeah, I mean, it was...
That was literally the first show?
Literally the first show, and obviously yeah. You were then with the first
right,
band,
right,
so it was that.
Right.
You must have some good memories of that tour, because it was all really starting to...
It was great. It was the first major tour that we'd really been out on, certainly in the UK. I don't know, it just felt magical to me. And what a band to go out with. DC is just like... I don't know, I don't know how to describe it, except that every night felt like magic. You know, all the fans out there, just a sea of blue and black, and heads just all in, you know, unison, up and down and up and down for every song. And it was just amazing. And the cannons, you know, for those about to rock, that was the tour, yeah. You know, being lifted up and fire, boom, you know, and then them testing the pyro at sound check. And the very first show we played was Birmingham on that tour. And just before we went on stage, the entire crew of DC said to us, everybody that opens up for DC, especially in the UK, they're going to throw things at you. They're probably going to boo you. They're going to chant for AC/DC in the middle of your songs, during your songs. Just expect it. You're just going to get hell, you know? And we're like, okay, that's cool. You know, we're ready for it. And so we went out there. Of course, nothing thrown at us, no booze, and the first night, an encore. Ever since we've come back, even 20, 30 years later, there's fans that meet and greets will go, you know, the first time I saw you was with AC/DC opening up at so-and-so, or, you know, on the UK tour. And I've been a fan ever since, and it's like, okay, there you go.
I remember you going down really, really well, and after the show, everybody was going, we better get some Y&T.
Right.
Which really doesn't happen very often.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So on the last night of that tour, there was a rumor that... Ozzy came to see you and had a conversation with you in the dressing room afterwards.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, it was true. Yeah. It was kind of weird. I mean, it was a little weird because he asked me in front of the guys. You know, we got off stage. We all came back. We were all on a high. It was the end of the tour. You know, Dublin was great. The audience was great. And here's Ozzy and Sharon back there waiting for us in our dressing room. And it was a big room. And the guys walked about 20, 30 feet away from me. And Ozzy gets down on his knees and says, Dave, will you please join my band? And, you know, all of a sudden, Ozzy's at my feet asking me to join his band. And I was like, what the hell's going on? This is weird. And Sharon's standing next to him. And all I could think of was, and I'll be honest, this is true. Oh my God, I'm embarrassed because my band members are standing right here. You know, this is embarrassing. You know, if I really wanted to do it, I would really feel guilty to say it in front of them, number one. But there was no question. I mean, it was, without even thinking about it twice, I just said, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, but no.
What was correct. The trigger for you guys to go, we need to do a new album now?
Every year we're out here for our own headline tour. We're out here in the summers doing the you know, the festivals and doing the states and so on and so forth. And we're doing 50 plus shows a year after year. And it's like, okay, now we're cemented. We got what we want. We're where we want to be. Now this band needs to do something to come up and say, you know, we're not just going to play just the hits. You know, we have something still to say. Everybody in this band wants to do some new material. And the fans are dying for it. Everybody keeps asking us for it at all the shows. I don't care even if it only sells 1,000 CDs, you know. Let's just do it because we need to do it. You know, we have to do it for ourselves. We have to be creative again. We can't just be, for the better part of it, you know, sort of like a tribute band to ourselves. themselves, you know what I mean?
It's funny because there are bands who are desperately trying to recreate some kind of 80s feel, but I think you guys effortlessly did it with the album. It just seems to kind of, not that it sounds like it's from the 80s, but
no,
the style
I know what
of
you
music,
mean.
Yeah. it just kind of seems to pick up where it left off.
Well, and part of that might be the fact that, you know, obviously it's just our style of writing, but the other part is from my perspective, is that's what I love about the rock music scene. You know, that's my style of music. You know, that's what I always sort of go towards. And it's not like I'm trying to keep myself pure by any means, but I really don't listen to most of the new stuff. So I don't have this infiltration of other sounding rock bands that we're going to put this new edge into. You know what I'm saying? I only listen to our style of rock music. When I'm at home, I listen to jazz, classical, R&B, and all the stuff that I grew up on listening to for the most part. I mean, you know, I feel like a dumbass a lot of times. You know, guys, you hear something on the radio and they go, you know that one, Night Dave? And I'm like, no. Well, that's Creed. Well, that's great, man. I don't know those guys. You know, I've heard the name, you know, and it's this guy, that guy, you know, all these huge bands. And I'm like, Jesus, I don't know if I've heard any songs from anybody. And that sounds terrible, I know. And it's not that I don't care. It's just, you know, when I'm at home, it feels too much like work to be listening to rock music of the new right now. I just like the stuff that I was born and raised on, and a few new things.
You've got every set list for the last 10 years, and you deliberately try and make sure that you're not playing the same kind of stuff, certainly in the same town twice. That's pretty considerate.
I suppose you could say it's considerate. You know, I'm the kind of guy that cares about delivering a good show every time we come out, because I don't want people to feel at any point when we're coming back year after year to the UK now, when we had stayed away for so long. I don't want anybody to start feeling like, okay, well, I've seen them the last couple of years. You know, there's no reason to go see them this year, you know. I want them to know that we're going to give them a different show every year.
Are there any songs that you still really look forward to playing, like when you know it's coming up in the set because of the reaction?
Yes, absolutely. Forever, of course, because it's just, you know, that song never fails to get me off, you know, and it's such a great tune to play. But in I Believe in You and I'll Cry for You, there are center sections of solo in each one of those songs where, forget about what you heard the solo like, oh, I Believe in You on the record. I'm just going to get off on however I feel tonight, you know. But that's going to be great most nights, you know, if you think about it, you know, because that's what you came to see the live show for. You want to see these guys truly inspired up on stage, you know, and that's how I'm going to be most inspired, when I can let it all happen, you know, and it's going to be fresh and new tonight. You know, this is a brand new performance every night. I Believe in You, because of the fact that I really truly have a lot of passion behind the solo, and I just get into playing, and some nights my head feels like it's going to explode, or I'm going to have an aneurysm or something because I'm so into it, that the crowd reacts that way. At the end of that song, it's just like sometimes the ovation goes on for like 35 or 45 seconds. You know, they won't stop and it'll just keep going. I'm like, oh man, they got it. You know, it was the connection is there. And that's what I love about live. I would have to say that 9 times out of 10, most of the songs that we've been putting down now from this new record have been getting equal response, if not better, in some regards, you know. When we finish I'm Coming Home, people just like, wow.
Some other place I should be. Where?
To hear them back, and if you want to find out why Dave turned Aussie down, the rest of that interview will be available later this month as part of the premium version of the show at classicrockpodcast.com. Robin George appeared looking wistfully atop a distant mountain on the cover of Kerrang! Issue 51 back in 1983 as he was hailed as the Axe of Tomorrow. His Dangerous Music album in 1985 and the single Heartline, which you heard at the top of the show, were his most visible moments for most of us. You'd be forgiven for thinking that was it for him, but in fact he's been working consistently ever since as both performer and producer with a few artists you've probably heard of. He now lives up his own mountain in Spain, thank you very much, and as his back catalogue of solo and collaborative efforts are now almost all re-released through the Angel Air label, I thought we should find out exactly who he's been hanging out with all these years.
Well, it all started, I suppose, I had a deal with Arista Records, which led to the front cover of Kerrang! They called it the History 12-inch because they wanted it out quick. They didn't want to wait for the whole album. And it sort of made a few ripples, as we say in Kerrang! Etc. And then I sort of started working with producing various acts from Rathchilds to Quartz, which then led to Bronze Records becoming aware of me. And that led to the Dangerous Music album, which, as you said, is probably the best known thing from that era from me. Went on to work with, as I say, the order I'm not particularly certain of, but I did quite a lot of work with Robert Plant on demos for his Now and Zen album. Did an album with Glenn Hughes, which never saw the light of day. And then went on to form a band called Notorious with Sean Harris from Diamond Head, who I produced their first ever single. It's called Sweet and Innocent. So we formed Notorious, made an absolutely great album's worth of demos, and got a major deal And then it all stopped again because the company we signed to fell out with their American counterparts and they just pulled our record.
Now, you also, of course, worked with Phil Lynott. He played on your album, and I think for the briefest period you were actually part of a reformed Thin Lizzy, weren't you?
Strangely, I first met him. I auditioned for Lizzy, and it didn't kind of work out for various reasons. Phil wanted me in the band, he told me afterwards, and when he was making his 19 single, he called me up and said, "Will you return the favour? I played on your album. Come and play on my single." So I said, "Yeah, I'd love to, you know." And we were promoting it, flying back from, I think it was Newcastle, I think it was the Tube. There was Brian Downey, the drummer, me and Phil on the plane, and Phil said, "I want to reform Thin Lizzy, are you in?" And we both went, "Yeah, of course, yeah, we'd love to." And so we'd been writing together quite a lot, so we continued very briefly over just leading up to Christmas. Did some great writing, and the next thing I knew, a radio station called up and said, "Can you comment on Phil's demise?" You know, and that was the first I knew about it. I knew he wasn't very well, but I didn't have any idea that he was in such a terrible state that he was, bless him, you know. So yeah, I was in Thin Lizzy for about 20 minutes, something like that. But it was, you know, it was real. The album would have been great. I mean, my memories of the tracks are really, really very fond and very strong indeed. So he wanted to go back to, you know, where it all started. Had great record company interest. And as I say, the writing was great. We were demoing in, he had a little studio in his back garden in Kew. And it was all sounding fantastic. I was leaving to go back to, I at the time was living in Wolverhampton. And he said, "Oh, I'll get my driver to take you to the station. In fact, I'll come along so we can have a chat on the way." And just as we pulled into Euston, he said, "Oh, can I just have the tape of all the stuff so I can be working on it over Christmas? Because, you know, I really want to get this ready for the new year." And of course, never saw it again. So that was the only copy. Because I'm one of these guys, I used to record everything, always make sure I had a copy of everything that I ever did, just because I had a tape recorder and I could be bothered to switch it on, I suppose. So, yeah, all that went with everything else of his into somebody's got it somewhere, but I don't know who and I don't know where.
Now, something we've kind of deliberately skipped over, I guess, because we're going to talk about it in some detail, is your collaboration with David Byron, the former singer with Uriah Heep. Now, this happened all really before all the Dangerous Music thing, but how did you guys get together? Because it's an unlikely partnership on the face of it.
I remember the first time he ever rang me up, I was taking a bath, like you do, and he said, "It's David Byron, I want to meet you." So I jumped in the car with a good friend of mine, and we drove down to this studio in Worcester, and as we pulled into this pub car park, there was this bloke asleep on the floor, sprawled, absolutely spark out he was. And this guy came out the pub and said, "Hi, I'm Pete Thompson," who's a fantastic drummer. I don't know if you know, he's working with Robin Trower at the moment. He said, "You get one arm, I'll get his legs. You, the other guy, get his other arm." We carried him into the pub. And he came round. The first thing he said to my friend was like, "What the are you looking at?" And like, really sparky. And I said, "Hello, David, I'm Robin." And instantly there was something took place, and the rock and roll cuddle, etc. And he continued to have a few more bevvies, like he did. But we hit it off, big star. So he invited me down to, he had a beautiful mansion in Sonning, in just outside Reading, to do some writing. And I stayed there for a year, basically, and wrote the On the Rocks album and a lot of other stuff as well.
David had well-documented drink problems, which did for him in the end, didn't they? But you seemed to bring out the best in him. Did you ever have any issues with his professionalism or in trouble when you were working together?
I can't ever remember having a stand-up row with David, but obviously we were both quite volatile people when it came to it. And the fact that I would stand up to him and not just kowtow like people did, I think that helped. But the other thing is, we became very good friends. I mean, I saw him a couple of states, like, you know, like you can imagine, and especially when we were touring. But then so was everybody else, you know. You finish the gig, you party. So he was not in any way abnormal in that way. But in his everyday life, if he wasn't working, yes, he was a drinker. And he would have admitted that as well. But the point being, when he needed to be somewhere, he was there. He was on time, he was professional, and boy, could he still perform. I mean, the tour we did, he was absolutely brilliant. He really was. What a front man.
As we mentioned before, Angel Air have been steadily releasing all of Robin's stuff, including the Notorious album with Sean Harris, Damage Control, which was his project with Pete Way of UFO, and Chris Slade, the former drummer with AC/DC, Cocoon by Life, which was Robin George and Nick Tart from Diamond Head, plus Lost and Found, and most recently On the Rocks by the David Byron Band. Robin's pick from that one is David's favourite, Bad Girl. I wanna The Guitar Nation show runs on the 13th and 14th of November at Olympia in London and is basically the ultimate guitar show. Basically all the manufacturers are going to be there, so you can practice your Stairway to Heaven on virtually anything you want. Of special interest this year is a masterclass being given by none other than Steve Vai. To find out more, you can head for guitarnation2010.com. That link will be in our programme notes. Plus, we have a competition for 5 free pairs of tickets. Just email your name and telephone number or email address to news@classicrockpodcast.com, and if you're quick, you can have them for free. Again, that link is on the show notes at classicrockpodcast.com. Steve Hackett made a name for himself as a member of Genesis between 1970 and 1977, leaving the group after six studio albums to pursue a solo career. A virtuoso guitarist and renowned singer-songwriter, his most recent recording, Out of the Tunnel's Mouth, has received arguably the greatest plaudits of his career to date. He continues to tour relentlessly, and as he prepares another jaunt across Blighty, I chatted to him about bits and bobs, starting with his double appearance at this summer's High Voltage Festival in London.
Yeah, I thought it was a fantastic festival. Great weather for both days. I did manage to play with two bands. I mean, I was with Transatlantic the night before. I joined them for their encore. And then on the Sunday, I played with my band.
Now, aside from that, you've already toured to support Out of the Tunnel's Mouth, and you're back over here to tour again in November, and you've been doing plenty of other shows in between, yeah?
I have, yeah. I've been all over the world. I've done practically 150 shows back to back. So it's been a very busy time. The last 2 years of touring have been flat out, but I like that. You know, I feel that that's like making up for lost time in a way. You know, there were some previous years when touring was much more discouraged, and now, of course, it's the mainstay of the industry, which suits me fine because I like being on the road better than anything else, frankly.
Now, even though the album Out of the Tunnel's Mouth has been out for a while, it continues to receive plaudits from all over the place. It was up for Best Album of the Year for the Classic Rock Awards, and there's a mixture of styles on the album, and all together is a really fine collection of music, I think.
Well, there's a lot of influences. It runs the gamut, and it's across the whole of the musical spectrum, really. Everything from rock to flamenco to blues to jazzier moments, the influence of world music or regional music, as I prefer to call it. It's just we haven't always been in touch with the next village, and suddenly it gets an awful lot of subscribers. There's so much going on out there, but I love playing nylon as well as electric. So my future is kind of mixed between the two. I can enjoy myself as much playing electric music. I can enjoy myself equally well doing acoustic stuff. At the end of the day, I think of it as a rock album. Okay, so you might have tinkling musical boxes, you might have trains roaring, you might have all sorts of things, but at the end of the day, it's still under the auspices of mainstream rock. It's just that we've managed to stretch the parameters slightly, so there are things included that perhaps you wouldn't get with most metal bands, but I'm not decrying the genre of metal at all. I mean, I grew up listening to this stuff. That's what I loved. You know, that's what I wanted to be at age 18. I wanted to be what Joe Satriani became, but that's me in 1968.
There's quite a lot of new bands out there playing, I guess, what you'd call classic rock, and there's quite a lot of new bands playing prog rock. Are you finding a new audience for your stuff as well as the old guard?
Well, I am, because a lot of the new guard that are coming up are mentioning me as an influence, and sometimes I'm working with them. I'm thinking of Muse, for instance, and I find that very interesting, you know, both the whole sort of very emotional singing style and the fact that they'll halfway through a piece wander off into a piece of Chopin, and I think, oh well, you know, that's all the sort of stuff I was telling people that they could do years ago, and when record companies were shaking their heads sadly going, oh my god, what's he doing? So that's great, and I've been working with Stephen Wilson of Porcupine Tree, who I think all the things that perhaps Genesis lost over time, they're all the things that he's interested in. You know, the more streamlined that the mainstream became, it seems as if, you know, the second wave of bands that, I don't know whether you'd call them progressive or classic rock or whatever, you know, seem to manage to combine all the influences and take the inclusive approach rather than exclusive.
Talking of Genesis, I mean, you play a lot of the stuff in the set. Do you think it's down to you now to make that music heard? Are you the keeper of the flame now?
Well, it's funny that, isn't it? I think that, you know, the chances of a full Genesis reunion, as we know, are always possible, but increasingly unlikely. I've always said I'm up for it. But the main thing is that I have such affection for the songs that we did, so I'm still carrying whatever it is. Maybe I'm the keeper of the flame of that And I go along and I cheer on the tribute bands and try and be of assistance. But I still enjoy playing some of that material. About a third of what I do live is Genesis stuff, stuff that I wrote when I was with the band, stuff that I helped arrange when I was in the band, the songs which wouldn't have happened if I hadn't, you know, pushed for us getting a Mellotron and a synth. I mean, don't they sound like old things now? It's like saying, I pushed them to get a box Brownie camera way back in 1999 because I knew that photography was going to be, you know, the next big thing. But it's, I still have an enormous affection, you know, for those early struggles and tunes that were full of great ideas where we struggled to execute them, and the early albums aren't particularly in tune or in time, but then again neither was Sergeant Pepper, and it's the power of the ideas at the end of the day.
And as we said at the top of that piece, Steve is touring throughout November and early December, starting on the 16th of November in Southampton. The dates are on the show notes for this particular show at classicrockpodcast.com. Off the new album, Out of the Tunnel's Mouth, this is Tubehead. Plenty of live shows to go and see in November. Steve Hackett, we've already talked about, and the wonderful Cheap Trick are doing Wolverhampton, Manchester and London. If you're quick, Motorhead have got a full tour. They're doing all the usual haunts in the UK this month, and well worth a visit anyway, of course, but this time supported by Michael Munro and his band, which currently includes Ginger from the Wild Hearts and Steve Conti from the New York Dolls. If you're in Red Hill on November the 20th, you should probably head for the Harlequin, where Praying Mantis and Weapon will be strutting their new wave of British heavy metal stuff. Talking to which, Marseille, who we interviewed on the last show, have got some more UK dates at the end of November. And Skunk Anansie, supported by the excellent New Virgin Marys, are also out for the second part of the month. Talking of new bands, LA retro rockers White Wizard are playing up until the 14th of November, supported by Primitai. And you can hear both of those bands as part of our premium content show in the new Classic Rock and Metal Next Generation show, which is available from the middle of the month at classicrockpodcast.com. That's all new bands. And finally, the Unmissable Wasp are back, so lock up your daughters and catch them from November the 20th at Nottingham's Rock City right up until the 28th at the Mandela Hall in Belfast. Finally, the new releases for this month, and Velvet Revolver have a Live in Houston DVD out that was filmed in 2005. There's a new Doors Live in Vancouver from 1970, which is out on the 22nd, that's a two-disc set, and Joe Bonamassa's Royal Albert Hall performance from May 2009 is out on double CD and Blu-ray. The Stones have two vinyl box sets out containing every studio album from 1964 right up to 2005. They've all been remastered and they're out in 180-gram heavyweight vinyl. Tank, the new wave of British heavy metal band from the early 80s, have a new album out, War Machine, featuring Doogie White, who you may recall sang on the last Rainbow album, and we'll be playing some of that and talking to Cliff Evans from the band in next month's show. AOR favourite Strangeways are back with a new album, Perfect World, out through Frontiers, featuring Terry Brock on vocals, and you may recall we played a track from his recent solo album, Diamond Blue, a couple of shows back. There's a Heaven and Hell DVD and CD out on November the 16th from Eagle Rock, and that features the band's performance at the Wacken Festival in Germany in 2009. On the subject of Ronnie Dio and Heaven and Hell, the Niji Entertainment Group, which was the company formed by Dio and his wife Wendy, issue their first release this month, which is a fantastic two-disc CD set featuring his performances at the Castle Donington Monsters of Rock Festival in the UK in 1983 and again in 1987, both memorable shows. Thanks to Niji, we have three copies of that to give away, and again, all you have to do is email us your name and phone number or email address to news@classicrockpodcast.com, and if you're one of the first three to do that, we'll gladly send one on to you. We'll be back on the first Monday of December with a bumper show for Christmas, and in the meantime, do feel free to get in touch by going to classicrockpodcast.com and either email us or call the studio line on 020 8144 9222. Have a good month, and by the way, you didn't really think we were going to let Bill Ward go without asking him the $64,000 question, did you?
Ozzy had originally spoke to me about 2 months ago about the possibility of doing a brand new album and possibly a tour, and I said, okay, all right. So I've spoken to Tony and I've spoken to Geezer, and they both have very positive outlooks towards it, and so do I. I can verify that and I know there's been some press about it already, I can verify that we are. So all of us are definitely talking to each other at this time. That is happening. So.